Growing up in the early 70s with two energetic parents and younger brother, Rhiannon Tudor Edwards' childhood seemed idyllic. Her home was filled with a menagerie of pets. Holidays were spent on Barmouth Beach, splashing in rock pools. But this changed aged four when, on a trip to the countryside, her parents realised she couldn't see to pick bilberries from a bush. Now, after a week in hospital undergoing tests, she was diagnosed with a degenerative eye condition, retinitis pigmentosa, a diagnosis which might have shattered hopes and dreams. But Rhiannon has been determined to succeed, and she joins me now. Hi, Rhiannon.
Hello, hello.
Nice to talk with you. Now, take us back to your childhood. How did that diagnosis of RP affect your parents?
Well, my father was a doctor and my mother a physiotherapist, so they were medical. My dad was a very busy doctor, so my mum, I know, was at my bedside in hospital at Moorfields, and I was very little, and I do still remember the bright lights and I remember that Mary as well, the play lady at Moorfields, and painting pictures, and they were very dark pictures of fish. So whether that was my mood at the time, lots of tropical fish. I think there must have been tropical fish on the ward. But, you know, it was a bit tough, and I was told I wouldn't see, or my parents were told I wouldn't see anything by age 15. I'm now 51 and still have a little tiny bit of useful sight. So, you know, the old valiant eyes are doing quite well, really.
Were you aware at that age that there was something wrong with your eyesight?
Yes, I definitely couldn't read out aloud in school. It still fills me with horror memories of that. And, oh, netball was wonderful, you know, being hit in the face by a lot of ball in mainstream school. But, you know, I did all things I did. I rode a pony, I rode a bicycle, I did everything, but it was reading was really difficult, and I progressively lost my central sight. So I've got a sort of reverse version of RP with a tiny bit of residual field, a tiny bit of colour left as well by now, which I'm really grateful for. And but really nothing at all in central sight. So, you know, I did everything. I enjoyed life as a child, but things got a bit more progressively difficult through my teens, and I couldn't read after the age of about 16, 17.
When you were at school and going through your education, were the school aware that you had a problem?
Yes, I suppose they were. Sorry, those are seagulls. It's North Wales here. yes, I suppose they were. I didn't have a lot of help in school, or I think possibly I had a few extra minutes of time in exams. But no, there wasn't at that time help like there is now for students. And then I got to university, and again I was, you know, needing a bit of extra help with, in those days it was overhead projection and lecture notes, and it did. You know, things are much, much better in university for students today in terms of appropriate help, as it should be.
And what about your friends? You know, did you find this impacted on your social life as far as friendships with school and things?
That's an interesting question. I think really that the sight loss happened late, significantly in my late teens and 20s. So I think as a youngster, you know, maybe they needed to take a little bit more care. I couldn't see in the dark, actually. I remember that now. That was always more difficult.
And I suppose it can affect your confidence if you let it as well.
Well, that's right. And but, you know, I think getting out and doing activities is one of the best things that all young people should be doing. And if you have a disability, it's great if you can engage in those sort of things too.
Of course, sooner or later, you were unable to go riding on your own. How did that impact you?
Well, do you know what? I was out last night on my 20-year-old pony. I have found that the hardest thing, to have to relinquish that wonderful freedom. You know, we now live on Anglesey and have a field, so it's not a high-cost interest for me. You know, I've always dreamt of having a pony in the garden, and but I'm very lucky because I work at university and there are students who are willing to come and help me. So I have, if you like, a guide I have a guide dog and I have a guide horse, which is actually, I ride out in company and it's all very gentle and potter around. I think the message is, you can carry on doing the things you love, but you have to find ways around it. And often that's companionable because you have somebody who can come with you and they get a lot out of it as well. The students who help me, I know, get a lot out of it. And also you can find other interests, and I've enjoyed rowing. So, you know, you can carry on doing the things, but it is hard losing that freedom, I think. That I've always found that difficult.
And you mentioned your guide dog there. What was the transition like, starting to have to rely on a guide dog?
So I was lucky, I think, because in my early 30s, I had two young children, William and Nonny. And the local guide dog people in North Wales suggested I had a guide dog quite early to maintain confidence. And so Vicky, I matched up with Vicky. I went to Leamington Spa. I didn't find the adjustment easy. I remember, you know, a few tears when I picked up the harness for the first time, because it is about, I had always walked around with a thimble cane before that, but it is about becoming a more visibly disabled person. But actually, I had fantastic training, and I had the highest regard for guide dogs as an association and a charity. They are amazing, and they enable people. I mean, I travel around the country and internationally with my guide dog now, with my work as a university professor. And actually, it's been the best part of losing my sight. It's been amazing to have the companionship of a rather hot black Labrador. Jazz is my second guide dog. She's coming up to 10. And I think hopefully guide dog number 3 will come along. And I'm hoping Jazz will stay with us and retire. We're able to do that.
Now, have you ever experienced sort of prejudice against your sight, or people perhaps patronising you because of the way you are with your sight?
No. I'm not the sort of person who really lets that happen. I do have a collection of ridiculous train stories. might find the way into a book one day of things people have said to me when I've been travelling on the train.
Give us an example.
Well, I'd been to the Medical Research Council about 10 years ago. I'd been to a meeting in London, travelling from North Wales with my guide dog. I had a nice suit on. I was looking nice, and I was going back up to beautiful North Wales, and I got on the train at Euston and was just, you know, popping the dog under the table as you do, making sure she wasn't going to get trodden on or anything. And a lady leant over the table and she said, "Looking at you, dear, makes me realise how very lucky I am." I didn't know what to say, luckily. I didn't say anything. I didn't say, "I earn a lot more than you, love."
But the thing is, I suppose in her way, she's trying to...
I don't know what she was trying to do. It wasn't appropriate.
And you've got more of those, I suppose.
I've got a lot more of those.
Now, that brings me on to your other passion, which is mentoring. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I suppose it's because work has been such an important part of my life as somebody with a disability. And I've benefited an awful lot from access to work, the workplace can be a very enabling place if you're lucky enough to have a job where you have control, which is the sort of job I've had. So I trained a few years ago as a coach and mentor, qualified with the Institute for Leadership and Management, and I'm still undergoing further training because it's something I feel very strongly about. That and the RNIB has actually asked me on several occasions to have young people come and spend time with me in the office, and they've been so I've had three completely blind young ladies come and spend time with me, and I think it's been about encouraging them, finding out what they're interested about, not necessarily my subject, encouraging them to function in a fully sighted office environment to gain confidence. Couple of them have had their guide dogs while they've been here and started travelling independently to work, and just, you know, that whole thing about being an equal in the workplace but having to do things in a slightly different way. So the staff I work with have to get used to reading stuff aloud to me all the time, And it works. It's very companionable. It's great. I'm one of the best proofreaders because I listen to stuff being read out. I can hear mistakes, you know, when you're doing those final proofreads on a report or document. So I think it's a rewarding thing to do, mentoring. And I think, you know, only I think the statistics are that that of the working age population, 74% are of people without disabilities are working. And amongst visually impaired people, it's 26%. So, you know, the statistics of how many visually impaired people are working are poor. And this is, I know it's something that the RNIB has prepared a big report on in a few years ago. And it is something I feel really passionate about, because actually, if you're working, you're earning. If you're earning, that gives you choices for help. And, you know, we all have talents, and we all have to learn to work in different ways. It's not one way of working. And with the technology we have now, with screen readers such as JAWS, I mean, there are many products available. And then the lovely iPhone and other Android phones that come with speech on them, technology is possible. You know, I've just now sent a tweet out a minute ago about a meeting in London later this month. And I make great use of my reading assistant through Access to Work. And that's, again, a very rewarding, you know, companionable relationship. It's funny when there are mornings when you don't feel like going to work, and then you think, oh, bloody hell, I've got a reader there, I'll have to go to work. and that's great, you know, that's great. So, yes.
And I suppose part of the mentoring as well is that really not often do, whether you've got vision problems or not, it's very rare that you're offered things on a plate. You do have to fight for things, don't you?
Well, you do. And you do have to. And you have to think, I've been lucky because I was able to have a good education through mainstream comprehensive school, university, and then carry on with my academic career. And I did a TEDx talk actually if you want to find it, it's on Rhiannon Tudred with Holly Head TEDx, and it's about resilience through sight loss. And I did say in that how important encouraging young people to get qualifications is, because, you know, nobody can argue with qualifications on your CV. And then you know, you can say, and by the way, I don't see very well, or I'm blind and I need this, I have this technology, or I have this help from Access to Work, and here I am, I'm doing this job, and I'm doing it perhaps in a slightly different way, but I'm adding to your research, your team at work. You know, I've got a lot to offer, and that's the culture I really want for young people.
And I suppose social media, the positive side of it, can help in this kind of thing, can't it?
Well, it does, and even socially, you know, I can't read a notice board up in my village, and yet I'm on a social media group, and I hear, you know, I can listen to what the feed is of what's happening. So it can be very inclusive, actually.
And your mum, well, your mum thinks you're a superhero.
No, not at all. I'm very lucky. She's the superhero. You know, we've gone through quite a lot as a family, and we've lost my dad now, and but she's great. She's going to be 80. At the end of this month, and we're having a big family party. That's lovely.
Sounds nice. So what could have been a crushing diagnosis way back in the early 70s, actually, well, things have turned out all right, haven't they?
Well, they have. They have. And I've just started a new hobby, gardening. I have to remember what I've planted where. Quite funny, really. You have to have a sense of humour, don't you?
Yeah, you have to. Yeah. No, I mean, I find it quite frustrating, some of the daft things I do, because, you know, that way, because you try not to make a fool of yourself, but, you know, I do it regularly.
Well, I bought two pairs of very lovely flip-flops, one for my lovely 19-year-old daughter and one pair for me, and I bought them two different colours so that we'd not argue, and then the other day I nearly left the house with one of each colour. Left and right, but they were from different pairs. Oh dear. Anyway, there we are.
That's almost trendy. So what's the future for you then? What would be your aims, and where would you like to go?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question. So professionally, I'm enjoying writing some books, going into next year, I've got a research team. I'm really happy to see them progressing into, you know, really rewarding. My husband and I now, Paul, we the children have gone to university, so we're finding time for some more holidays and interests. And I really enjoy my activities, which have included horse riding and rowing. And then I actually did a 20-mile tandem bike ride on Sunday, which was just an amazing experience. To join in a community event and be part of it, and be obviously on the back of the tandem. So yeah, it's great. Keeping going with those experiences is wonderful, and yeah, I feel very fortunate.
Well, it's been inspirational and fascinating chatting with you, Rhiannon Tudor Edwards. We wish you the best for the future. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.